The Spectator is searching for the UK's brightest entrepreneurs to enter the Spectator Economic Innovator of the Year Awards in partnership with Charles Stanley Wealth Managers. If you have a business that disrupts an existing market, a smart new way of doing things, or something that has incredible social impact, then apply by 1st of July at spectator.co.uk/innovator. Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Every week, a few of our favourite writers read out their articles in the latest issue of The Spectator. This week, the deputy political editor of The Spectator, Katie Balls, reads her political column. She argues that the biggest danger to Boris comes from the enemies within. Then she'll be followed by Laura Freeman, who takes a look at what kind of art ministers hang on their walls and what that says about them. And finally, we'll be joined by the author Adam Sisman, who reviews a new book by Giles Milton called Checkmate in Berlin, the Cold War Showdown that Shaped the Modern World. First is Katie Balls.
Boris Johnson's predecessor was destroyed by her inability to meet deadlines. Theresa May extended the Brexit transition period so many times that her party eventually turned against her. Johnson, who was notorious for pushing deadlines when he was a journalist, is now discovering the political problem with missing dates. The Prime Minister may still be flying high in the polls, but if he cannot meet the new date for ending restrictions, 19 July, then his own MPs will lose faith in his ability to restore normality. The whole point of the government's staggeringly long lockdown timetable, announced back in February, was to set an achievable deadline. The theory was that by 21st of June, a high vaccination rate would mean there was no question of hospitals being overwhelmed. The roadmap would offer certainty, a final end to intermittent lockdowns. Just last week, the hospitality sector is preparing to operate at full capacity, placing orders and hiring staff. Even ministers were sending out invitations to their book launches and summer parties. Those events are off. After cases of the Indian variant soared, scientists warned that the peak of hospitalizations could rival the first wave. So Johnson announced a four-week delay to the roadmap, with a promise of a review 2 weeks in. He said that this time, the date really will be a terminus. Ministers are at pains to appear optimistic. Michael Gove has said that only something unprecedented and remarkable could derail the latest roadmap. But as recently as last week, he claimed that if he were a betting man, he'd put money on lockdown ending on 21st of June. The irony is that millions of businesses and restaurants have bet money on precisely that. Polling suggests that the public supports the continuation of restrictions, but in Parliament, it is a different matter. The Prime Minister is under fire from all sides. On Monday, Lindsay Hoyle, the Speaker, accused the government of misleading the House by announcing a delay in a press conference rather than the Commons floor. Misleading the House is traditionally a cause for ministerial resignation. Labour has been quick to go on the attack. The party, as ever, supports the lockdown but blames the need for a delay on Johnson's incompetence, citing his failure to ban flights from India once the variant of concern was first identified. Yet, of all the Prime Minister's current critics, it's his own MPs who ought to worry him the most. Ever since the first lockdown, there has been grumbling from Tory backbenchers, often to little avail. Keir Starmer's support for the restrictions makes rebellions useless. The frequency with which members of the party's COVID recovery group objects means that their complaints are often not taken particularly seriously. This time, however, the whips have been struck by how many party loyalists and members on the payroll have been in touch to let their unhappiness be known. Everyone is seething, says one member of the 2019 intake. It's not just the usual suspects this time. While Cabinet collective responsibility is broadly holding, there are hints of slippage. I don't support a delay. Few of us do, says the senior minister, but it's not up to me. Some are even edging off message publicly. The leader of the House, Jacob Rees-Mogg, warned in a podcast this week that you can't run a society just to stop the hospitals being filled. What worries the Tory dissenters more isn't the economic or social damage done by a four-week delay. Most can live with that, particularly if it means normality by the school holidays. The worry is that once the end of lockdown has been delayed, it is easier to do it again. The SAGE document suggests that in a few weeks' time, the number of hospitalisations will be nearing its peak. If the number of cases and hospitalisations are worse, does Boris really have the nerve to unlock then? Asked one Tory MP. It's still possible that the data will allow the Prime Minister to reopen in 2 weeks' time, But even if there is a further easing, scientists may want to bring back more rules in the autumn when seasonal viruses start to circulate. If they are acting like this in June, we are going to be locked down again by October, says one advisor to the government. A former minister adds, anyone who thinks it's just another few weeks and we'll see this thing off is simply not following the logic of what delay means here. I fear this is a zero COVID strategy. In the meantime, Health Secretary Matt Hancock has been going into battle with Red Wall Tories from the 2019 intake on the Health WhatsApp group. It's a very polite debate, with Hancock posting graphs of hospitalisations and MPs replying with graphs of low deaths, says one MP. This perhaps explains why Number 10 is talking as if the removal of restrictions on 19 July is certain. It is to keep the troops in order. Civil servants have started to work on the decriminalisation of COVID rules. Johnson hinted at this in Monday's press conference when he suggested some people may choose to continue with sensible behaviour, like keeping social distancing. Masks are likely to remain mandatory for public transport. There is also a revival of interest in an immunoprivilege system, which would give freedoms to fully vaccinated people, foreign holidays, for example, that would not be afforded to others. It's a global trend, says one figure involved in the plans. For as long as Labour MPs support lockdown, the Tory rebels know their cause is doomed, but they can defeat the government in other places. Look at planning. That's where a lot of my colleagues plan to take it out on the government, says one Southern MP. MPs believe there's little chance of Johnson's planning reform bill making it through. Tories who've been canvassing in Chesham and Amersham ahead of the by-election reported that the Lib Dems' hyperbolic warnings would damage them. It did. They lost the seat. Johnson's majority of 80 means he remains in a powerful position, but his critics are growing in number. He may find that after lockdown ends, he is left with an unhappy, disappointed, and recalcitrant party waiting for the right moment to take its revenge.
That was Katie Bowes. And now, Laura Freeman.
The Art of Government. What politicians' paintings say about them. On the walls of the Chancellor's office hangs a print of Eric Revilius' lithograph, Working Controls While Submerged. Two engineers in blue overalls heave the levers of a submarine. A third slumps asleep on a bench. An image, perhaps, of the ship of state, several hundred feet underwater, but by no means sunk yet. We might picture the Chancellor in the Treasury control room, changing the gears, working the pumps, keeping the country bumping along, even at the bottom of the economic ocean. Or perhaps Sunak looks at his four framed screen prints by the artist Justine Smith, pound, euro, dollar, yen, and thinks, if only it were so easy just to print money. Maybe he turns to the portraits of Disraeli and Gladstone after Millet, and asks, well, chaps, what would you do? A raid on the government art collection is a perk of being a minister. Better than the car and driver, better than the polished red box. If I am ever appointed to one of the great offices of state, stranger things have happened to former Spectator hacks, the first thing I'd do is furnish my office. A few Hogarth etchings, a set of David Jones's Ancient Mariner etchings, Cedric Morris's Irises and Tulips, Edward Borden's The Coal Exchange. I'd have liked to nab Winifred Nicholson's flower piece, if only Carrie hadn't got there first. A Freedom of Information request from The Spectator has lifted the little red velvet curtains on which works of art ministers have got from the vaults. Mr. and Mrs. Johnson are the most prolific borrowers, having signed out 44 works for the Prime Minister's flat at number 11. Their eclectic selection is of a piece with their Lulu Little Interiors style. A bit of this, a bit of that, a busy mix, luxury clutter. There's a smidge of a green and eco vibe too in Howard Hodgkin's Herb Garden and Jessica Dismore's Landscape with Trees. Meanwhile, Alan Jones's Hamlet lithograph, outrageously quilted and roughed, should be a spur to Boris as he battles with his overdue Shakespeare book. If the muse deserts him, there are nine others on the wall. Joe Tilson's Aquatints of Calliope, Urania, Erato, Terpsichore, Polyhymnia, Thalia, Melpomene, Euterpe and Clio, apologies for pronunciation, Rhetoric, Astronomy, Poetry, Dance, Geometry, Comedy, Tragedy, Music and History, must be an inspiration for speeches, columns, memoirs and diaries. As for the Chancellor's flat at number 10, we may not know who designed the wallpaper, the people have a right to know, but we can tell that Sunak is very much a mid-century modern man. Sunak has gone big on Barbara Hepworth with 8 screen prints of assorted abstract shapes and forms. I can't help seeing all those holes and voids as a metaphor for the national budget. For relief and escapism, there are Ivan Hitchens's 2 poppies on a blue table, Graham Sutherland's cornfield and stone, and Keith Vaughan's rocky landscape. Anthony Gormley's aquatint Untitled shows a lone figure pierced with myriad spikes like a martyred St. Sebastian. A chancellor bears many burdens. Then there's Jake and Dinos Chapman's screen print, Double Death's Head, which acts perhaps as a memento mori, a vanitas vanitatum, a check against too much ambition. Stop me when I get too sudi. The Government Art Collection, founded in 1899, is an often overlooked national treasure trove. The collection of more than 14,000 works is lent not only to ministers, but to embassies, cultural institutes, civic spaces and exhibitions, and it continues to grow. Recent acquisitions include prints by Yinka Shonabare, terrific, and Tacita Dean, tedious. Some ministers defy expectations. Jacob Rees-Mogg, Honourable Member for the 18th Century, is groovier than you might think. Alongside a painting after Van Dyck's King Charles I, hang prints by the contemporary artists Holly Hendry, Eva Rothschild and Christine Baumgartner. Really quite cool choices from the thoroughly modern Mogg. Foreign Secretary and former university wrestler Dominic Raab has borrowed only one work, Sam Rabin's wax crayon drawing, The Prelude, a vertiginous ringside portrait of a wrestling match master of ceremonies. While an art student at the Slade, Rabin moonlighted as a wrestler and as an amateur won a bronze medal at the 1928 Amsterdam Olympics. He starred as a court wrestler in the 1933 film The Private Life of Henry VIII and as a prize fighter in the film of The Scarlet Pimpernel the following year. Raab's Rabin has the ring of a truly personal choice. Financial Secretary to the Treasury Jesse Norman, who published a biography of Edmund Burke in 2013, has adopted a portrait of Burke after Joshua Reynolds. Some civil servants dismiss the Department for Culture, Media and Sport as the Ministry of Fun. A playpen for lightweights and pleasure seekers and men who never say no to a jolly. For their part, culture journalists complain that DCMS ministers rarely know their arts from their elbow. Secretary of State Oliver Dowden had a typical hiccup this week, proudly tweeting from the G7 summit that the open-air Minack Theatre in Cornwall had been the recipient of COVID cash through the £2 billion Culture Recovery Fund. It hadn't. Still, Dowden wins points for borrowing works by women artists. Chantal Joffe's Red-Haired Woman in the Park, Lubaina Hamid's La Ruda, The Pulley, Gillian Waring's maquette for her statue of Millicent Fawcett, and for his evident affection for Her Majesty the Queen. Dowden has borrowed both David Bailey's smiling photo portrait of the monarch and Charles Moseley's 1953 coronation scene, The Procession in Whitehall. Michael Gove's portraits are mostly portraits of dead white statesmen. William Cecil, 1st Baron Burleigh, Henry St. John, 1st Viscount Bolingbroke, Robert Stuart, Viscount Castlereagh, and 2nd Marquess of Londonderry, with a bit of Bloomsbury ballast from Duncan Grant's The Downs near Wilmington. Education Secretary Gavin Williamson aligns himself with portraits of Sir Francis Drake, Sir Thomas More, and Oliver Cromwell. Yes, I quite see it. Strategy, intellect, and zeal. Rebecca Powell at DEFRA plays on a fruit and flowers theme with Vanessa Bell's Asters and Hydrangeas and Eileen Cooper's Lemon Tree. One of the works that appealed to me from the Chancellor's office was Chilla Kumari Singh Burman's Bengal Tiger Van, Raspberry Ripples, Chilla's Dad Selling Ice Cream on Freshfield Beach, Merseyside, 1976. Inkjet printed on an enlarged £10 note, Bengal Tiger Van shows holidaymakers queuing at an ice cream van with a great stripy cut-out tiger on the roof. This tiger was the symbol of Burman's father's ice cream business in 1960s Liverpool, at a time when many British Indians were in the ice cream game. The print is embellished with crystals in sari-like patterns. It is both blingy and sepia-tinted. Bengal Tiger Van happily captures the spirit of this staycation summer. Days out, heaving beaches, and well-behaved Great British queues. Buy a raspberry ripple. Top up the treasury pot.
That was Laura Freeman, and finally Adam Sisman.
Checkmate in Berlin. The Cold War Showdown That Shaped the Modern World by Giles Milton. When did the Cold War start? Not when the Second World War ended. There were many differences between the Soviet Union and its Western allies, but they did not then seem insuperable. It was not obvious that the post-war world would be divided by ideology. On the contrary, the victorious United Nations hoped for an era of peace. The Americans planned to pack up and leave Europe as soon as possible. The future of Germany had been decided before a single Allied soldier had crossed onto German soil. Meeting at Tehran in November 1943, the Big Three of Roosevelt, Churchill and Stalin had agreed that defeated Germany would be under military rule, divided into three zones of occupation, one each for America, Britain and Russia. Later, France would be admitted to this triumvirate. The same principle was to be applied to Berlin. But the former capital of the mighty Nazi Empire would be marooned deep in the Soviet sector, an island in a Soviet sea. Giles Milton, author of Nathaniel's Nutmeg and Churchill's Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, is a skillful storyteller. His new book, Vivid and Pacey, chronicles the first 4 years of the Berlin occupation through the first-hand accounts of the individuals involved. One stands out, Colonel Frank Hawley, first deputy commandant and then commandant of the American sector, a combative, rumbustious Texan who defied his more cautious superiors by adopting a policy of aggressive neutrality towards his Soviet counterparts. By the spring of 1945, Berlin was in ruins, pulverized by bombing and artillery bombardment. Occupying Allied soldiers were stunned by the devastation. If this were not enough, the Russians had looted everything they could carry, even stripping out the plant that controlled the water and electricity supply. They had ripped the very pipes from the walls. The city's beleaguered population stayed alive on scraps of food, keeping warm by burning firewood scavenged from the rubble. There were few young women who had not been raped by the soldiers of the Red Army. Only a handful of young men remained, many of them maimed in the fighting. The occupying forces set about reconstruction. The electricity and water supplies were restored, the hospitals rebuilt, and the U-Bahn began running again. Starvation was averted, but rations for ordinary Berliners were pitifully low, while the occupiers had more than they could consume. An army-issue corned beef sandwich was enough to lure many a hungry Fräulein into bed. In the bars and clubs that sprang up almost overnight to pay host to the incomers, the drinks were expensive, and the girls cheap. Corruption was rampant. Spies, gangsters and black marketeers flourished. Neither side had much compunction about recruiting former Nazis. The staff of Radio Berlin, until recently the mouthpiece of Goebbels' propaganda, remained in place. They just changed the colours of their shirts. There had been trouble between the occupying powers right from the start. The Soviets tried to restrict the number of American soldiers allowed into the city. But even once the Americans and British were established and had begun to bring some kind of order to their sectors, there was constant tension with the Russians, with sporadic gunfire after dark. In response to obstruction and even outright hostility from the Soviets, the other occupiers merged their administrations, becoming first Bizonia and then Trizonia. Relations with the Russians continued to deteriorate, culminating when a Red Army general was escorted from a railway HQ at gunpoint. There was a danger that serious fighting might erupt. Had the Russians been willing to risk war, they could have imposed their will on Berlin by force, since their troops vastly outnumbered those of the combined Western Allies. Instead, they decided to seal off the city, halting all road and rail traffic from the west from the 23rd of June 1948. Henceforth, Berlin was under siege. The only remaining route, in or out, was by air. Food, fuel, and medicines all needed to be flown in. Frank Hawley estimated the minimum needs of the 2.25 million people in the western sectors at 4,500 tons of supplies per day. It seemed impossible that so much could be brought in by plane. Given existing payloads, this would require a flight every 90 seconds, 24 hours a day, in all kinds of weather. Loading and unloading and subsequent distribution would have to be uninterrupted to avoid blockages. There would be no time for crews to disembark before taking off again. Round-the-clock maintenance would be required to cope with the wear and tear on the planes. Any aircraft that missed its landing slot would have to return to its point of origin with its cargo unloaded. And the incoming planes would have to endure harassment from Soviet fighters and incendiary fire, and searchlights trained to dazzle their pilots. Already one British plane had been brought down by a Soviet fighter. Ernest Bevin, the pugnacious British Foreign Secretary, was determined not to succumb to Russian pressure. He felt that the very future of Western Europe was at stake. In an earlier confrontation, he had come close to punching Molotov, the Soviet foreign minister. "We must stay in Berlin," Bevin declared. Addressing a huge demonstration, the largest in the city's history, the mayor of Berlin appealed to the peoples of the world. "You cannot, you must not forsake us." Faced with this escalation, the American president announced a dramatic shift in American foreign policy, which became known as the Truman Doctrine, to support free peoples who are resisting attempted subjugation. The administration inaugurated the Marshall Plan, a program of long-term economic support for the countries of Western Europe. In 1949, a new defensive alliance came into being, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, with America at its heart. Far from withdrawing, the United States had committed itself to staying in Europe. The Berlin airlift was a triumph of logistical planning. At its peak, on Easter Day 1949, a supply plane was landing in Berlin every minute of the 24 hours, bringing in almost 12,941 tons of supplies in a single day. After 323 days, the Russians relented and called off the siege. This was not checkmate, as the standoff in Berlin would continue another 40 years. But it was stalemate, and it felt like a victory.
That was Adam Sisman. Thanks for listening to this episode of Spectator Out Loud. Remember, you can read all of these articles and more like them if you take out a subscription to The Spectator. Just go to spectator.co.uk/voucher to get 12 issues of The Spectator for just £12. Thanks for listening, and join us again next week.